At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Broad-based, that is the economic term of the day, as in broad-based inflation. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday, July 13th. Good to have you with us. You've probably heard the headline number by now. The Consumer Price Index rose 9.1% in June compared to a year ago. That's the biggest increase since 1981. And it's what the Bureau of Labor Statistics calls broad-based, which is a euphemism for pretty much everywhere. That said, there were some particulars driving this month's surge. Some of them might be temporary, others not so much. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore looks ahead to see what might be in store.
In just 1 month, from May to June, prices rose 1.3%. The numbers haven't moved that much in a month in 17 years.
Energy was about half of that.
Justin Widener is a U.S. economist at Deutsche Bank. Inflation's number one driver in June was the cost of gasoline, up 60% year over year. But on the bright side,
gas prices are already down 40 cents from their peak. So with oil falling, gas prices should continue to decline.
So 6 months from now, we probably, knock on wood, won't be talking about gas prices driving up inflation. But inflation is running on a lot more than gas. Food was another big driver, up 10% year over year. Alan Detmeister is an economist at UBS.
We're likely to continue to see very strong increases in food prices, given the increases in wages, given the increases in food commodity prices over the last 6 months.
The war in Ukraine is still disrupting global food supplies and doesn't look like it's going to resolve anytime soon. And then rounding out the top three drivers of inflation last month, there's the rent,
which is a highly persistent and very sticky inflation measure.
Simon Harvey is with Monex Europe. The rent index rose 0.8% in June. That's the biggest monthly jump since 1986. And the nasty thing about rent is that it rarely ever goes down. But in, say, 6 months, Harvey says it should at least not be rising as much as it is now.
Shelter most probably will still be adding somewhat, nowhere near as much inflation pressure, but somewhat.
Now, looming behind all of this is, of course, the Federal Reserve trying to fight inflation by raising interest rates. These inflation numbers make it clear that fight is only just beginning. Again, Alan Detmeister at UBS.
This is showing inflation is still extremely strong. Very little sign that anything the Fed has done up to this point is slowing inflation yet.
Detmeister says the Fed's efforts may not show strong results until the beginning of next year. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders saw those inflation figures and ran. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Sabri talked about the role of oil prices in those inflation numbers. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen is currently in Asia trying to rally support for a price cap on Russian oil. From Tokyo, Yellen held a virtual meeting with her Chinese counterpart, Vice Premier Liu He, as part of her pitch to get China on board with the idea. The goal is to bring global energy prices down and deprive Russia of funding for its war in Ukraine. Marketplace's Lily Jamali has more.
A cartel usually calls to mind sellers banding together to try influencing a commodity's price. Think OPEC and oil. What the U.S. and allies are trying amounts to a buyer's cartel on Russian oil.
It's a brand new concept, an international scale like this.
Julia Friedlander, CEO of Atlantic Bruca, says energy sanctions imposed on Russia by the U.S. and the EU are having some effect, but not working perfectly. Initially, the U.S. aimed for a ban on Russian energy sales that would hurt Russia's economy, but there were still buyers for Russian oil, so the plan had to change.
It's a bit ironic because we were trying to pressure all Russian oil off the market at the same time, and now we're actually trying to keep Russian oil on the market.
But to keep the price low. So far, the West hasn't succeeded in choking off financing for Russia's war on Ukraine, says Christiana Baumeister of Notre Dame. She says for a price cap to work, India and China, two big buyers, would need to get on board.
The international cooperation of everybody who buys oil from Russia is the basis for successfully implementing this.
She says even if India and China agree to a price cap, they would still have incentives to cheat.
So if the price cap turns out to be $50 per barrel, what prevents them from offering $55 or $60? It's still a better deal for Russia and China and India, right?
Both India and China have been buying massive amounts of Russian oil, which has been selling at a deep discount due to Western sanctions, and that's hurting Russia, says Pavel Molchanov, an analyst with Raymond James, a marketplace underwriter.
Selling every barrel at $35 cheaper, that's a loss to the Russian economy of $200 million per day.
Or $70 billion per year. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
Among the many prices that went up in today's CPI report, food away from home, from snacks to meals, increased by just under 1% last month. It's up nearly 7.5% from a year ago, which is a good excuse to check in with Kristen Talheimer Bingham. She co-owns Dean's Sweets, a chocolate shop in Portland, Maine. She's one of our retail regulars and sent us this dispatch.
Business is good. We've definitely seen tourists come through. I talk with people every day from New York, Ohio, Texas, California. The second quarter for us was up 45% over the second quarter last year. And I attribute it to the resurgence of tourism in Maine, to being somewhat post-COVID, but not really, and to our continued work with hotels in the area, and of course, to our website traffic. As far as Costco, everything is increasing. Every time we order custom boxes, the price goes up. Our cost of shipping has increased. Chocolate prices, organic cream, butter too. These costs have gone up anywhere from 10 to 20%. And as another example, I just ordered heart-shaped boxes for Valentine's Day this past week. The price has basically doubled in the past 2 years. We've been able to maintain our staffing throughout the year, which is always our goal. But labor does continue to be our number one cost. To stay competitive and to keep our great team, we have raised our wages significantly. Around here, prices for housing and food and just basic living expenses shot up significantly. So in discussions with a few of our team members, they let us know in the best way possible that in order to keep our business functioning, we needed to increase wages. It was really a very humbling moment, but it was a great discussion, and we very quickly adjusted and felt that it was completely the right decision. Even with the increase in costs, we have not raised our prices, not in any significant way for several years. We're counting on the fact that we can absorb the higher costs of materials and labor because we do have the higher sales volume. Even after the summer is over, we get more and more traffic to our stores. And as for planning, we are doing everything we can to go into the fall as well prepared as possible for the fourth quarter. It really won't be very long until it's hot chocolate season again.
That's hard to believe. That was Kristen Talheimer Bingham of Dean's Sweets in Portland, Maine. If I say U.S. News and World Report, there's a good chance college rankings come to mind. The now digital-only media company has been evaluating colleges and universities since 1983. The methodology and outsized influence of those lists has been the source of much controversy over the years, including last week when U.S. News announced it was unranking Columbia University, formerly tied for the number two spot, over concerns about the validity of some of its data. Other colleges have come under fire for falsifying or misreporting data, and schools themselves have complained about how their data is being used. So what are students who are trying to make one of the biggest financial decisions of their lives to make of all this? Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes reports.
Prospective college students are drawn to names they know, says Jennifer Jesse. She's a college consultant in a suburb of Washington, D.C.
The college universe is kind of shaped by name brands, and that starts really early. So if you watch any TV show, any movie, even right now in the Marvel universe, you'll see MIT and Caltech being featured.
And Jesse says more than Marvel movies, the U.S. News rankings drive which schools are the biggest brands.
A higher-ranked college is not necessarily the best college for you, but you're working against all of this social pressure, and sometimes it ends up with students being in really dangerous situations in terms of debt.
Jesse says some things that U.S. News considers, applicants don't.
What college presidents like what schools, that's not what a student cares about. And a student doesn't really know what's in the rankings. They just know the rankings exist.
College administrators definitely know the rankings exist.
Honestly, I would have problems sleeping if the 2 or 3 days before the rankings came out.
Colin Diver was president of Reed College, and before that, dean of the University of Pennsylvania Law School. During his tenure at Penn, the law school's ranking bounced around between 7 and 12. Diver never tried to quantify the financial effects of going up or down a spot, but he knows it mattered.
Rankings were and are very influential in the decisions made by applicants, where to apply and what schools to enroll in. And that, of course, in turn, had a financial impact on the bottom line, and particularly because most colleges still depend very heavily on what they call full-pay students, that is, students who can afford to pay the full tuition and fees.
While Diver was at Penn, the law school, along with others, he says, changed admissions criteria to give more weight to an applicant's LSAT score. The idea was to boost the average standardized test score of the student body.
And we did that primarily because that was what U.S. News was using to rank law schools. And I always sort of regretted that.
Diver's the author of a new book called Breaking Ranks: How the Rankings Industry Rules Higher Education and What to Do About It. He calls college a complex product that's hard to quantify.
To take all of the colleges and universities in this incredibly diverse landscape and put a single straitjacket template on them strikes me as insanity.
But U.S. News and World Report is continuously evaluating what goes into its rankings, says the company's chairman and CEO, Eric Gertler.
We do think that our rankings are the most comprehensive. We think we have the most rigorous process that we go through. But we also accept that it's a start.
It's also a source of revenue for U.S. News. The company won't say how large. Seeing the rankings themselves is free, but an annual subscription to their College Compass product, with access to more detailed data about the schools, costs $39.95. And schools want to be included. Nathan Urban is provost of Lehigh University, a private school in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
Quite frankly, if you pulled us out of the rankings, or if we pulled ourselves out of the rankings, The people who would know about us would be the people who already know about us.
Urban says he hopes students take time to learn more about the school beyond just its ranking. Back in Virginia, college consultant Jennifer Jesse has this advice for students.
You can choose to subscribe to this college chaos, or you can choose to unsubscribe. And the way that you unsubscribe is you say, we're not looking for name brands. We're not looking at the rankings. We're looking for the right fit for you.
Because it's important to look beyond the numbers on a list when the number you're planning to spend is a really high one. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Often called in the business aesthetically elegant products.
Whatever that means. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average subtracted 208.7% to close at 30,772. The NASDAQ lost 17 points, 0.1% to finish at 11,247. And the S&P 500 fell 17 points, about 0.4%. To end at 3801. Now that Twitter has filed suit against Elon Musk, demanding that he complete his purchase of the social media network, some analysts are bullish on the company's chances of prevailing in court. Shares in Twitter gained 7.9% today. That put the price of a share at just over $34. Musk agreed to pay more than $54 a share. Delta Airlines reported a profitable quarter, its best since 2019, but not as good as analysts expected. Shares descended 4.5%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose, fell to 2.93%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. Today, AAA says a gallon of gasoline costs, on average, $4.63. And while that number has been falling the past few weeks, it's still about $1.50 higher than this time last year. When gas prices first started to spike back in March, some advocates for public transit saw this as an opportunity. Maybe those high prices would nudge more of us back onto city buses and trains. Well, that hasn't quite panned out, Marketplace's Savannah Marr reports.
Before the pandemic, San Francisco's BART trains carried about 400,000 people a day during the work week. But now,
we are carrying about 30 to 35% of the ridership that we did before March 2020.
BART spokesperson Chris Filippi says that's up slightly from the start of the year, but it's hard to say whether gas prices have anything to do with it.
We're in different times now, so we can't really make that correlation.
That's true across the country, says Stephen Miller with the Transit app. He says transit systems were designed around once predictable commuter habits that are now in flux.
There's a lot more remote work and hybrid work. People aren't using public transit as regularly.
Even with a slight boost from inflation, Miller says most systems in the U.S. are serving half of their pre-pandemic ridership. So how are they staying afloat?
Federal aid has been really helpful for transit agencies.
Like Kansas City's. Deputy CEO James Otten says pandemic aid helped fund a zero fare program for the city's buses.
So you get on our bus and you just sit down. You can even keep the $1.50 besides saving the gas money as well.
Otten credits that program with keeping ridership above the national average, around 80% of pre-pandemic levels. But that aid is finite, says Robert Puentes, who runs the Eno Center for Transportation, and agencies need to get creative to prove their value before it runs out.
There's an awful lot transit agencies can still do.
To recapture riders and replace lost commuters.
But it's getting late early, and they're going to need to start moving pretty quickly before these fiscal cliffs start to happen.
Before dips in ridership lead to budget cuts. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
It's sunscreen season, everybody. As anyone facing the morning struggle before sending their kids off to camp well knows. And who can blame the kids? Sunscreen, at least in this country, seems to come in just two textures, greasy or pasty. That has to do with the ingredients called filters that offer protection against harmful UV rays. And that matters because if it feels icky, people are less likely to use it. Amanda Mull is a staff writer at The Atlantic and wrote about this dilemma recently. And I was surprised to find out that other countries have better options.
Our sunscreens in the United States, they are a little bit less technologically advanced than some of what people have overseas. The FDA has not approved a new filter ingredient for use for broad use in the United States since the 1990s. In Europe, Asia, and Australia, they have almost double the filters available for cosmetic chemists that we have. These other filters are just a little bit easier to formulate into what is often called in the business aesthetically elegant products. We're not allowed to have them right now.
Something that people don't mind putting on.
Yes, things that feel good, things that are invisible on the skin, things that basically act like more of a skincare product than like a sunscreen. And I think a lot of people think of those things separately because the experience of using them is a little bit different.
So why has the FDA been slow to approve these other filters? Are there safety concerns about these chemicals?
Based on the people who I talk to, the safety concerns are not significant. Sunscreen is regulated by the FDA as an over-the-counter drug, which means that the active ingredients in it have to be deemed generally, let me see if I can remember the acronym, generally regarded as safe and effective. GRACE. Mm-hmm.
It's a graceful acronym, you might say.
Yes. Once these ingredients are approved, they're not proprietary. They're available for any manufacturer to use. So doing the amount of testing that the FDA requires for this approval is really expensive and really, really time consuming. And they're relying on private companies to do that. You've got companies on the one hand who are like, we don't want to do this. We have a lot of real world safety data because a lot of these products have been approved and in use in other countries, including in the European Union for 10 plus years. But it's not like exactly the kind of evidence that the FDA wants. And it's just sort of like this endless back and forth where none of the structures set up to move this forward are working very well because of the specific type of problem it is.
And yet, as you report, Americans are buying these products. How are people getting them? Is it legal to do so?
It is sort of a gray area. The internet, in its vast capacity to provide products to people, has given Americans opportunities to both learn about these products and to buy them. One that's particularly popular is a Biore sunscreen that feels like a skincare serum. I think I bought my tube for like $12 a couple years ago. And it's available from third-party sellers on Amazon. It's the same multinational cosmetics company that makes the pore strips that you rip out all the gunk from your nose with them. So, right. So these are companies that operate in the United States and market products in the United States, but there's just this category of product that they sell in many, many other countries that they can't sell here.
Do you have a sense that this is going to change? I mean, is the FDA catching on to the demand for these products and the need, right? Because as you write, skin cancer is the leading type of cancer in this country.
Right. You know, all of the experts that I spoke to really felt wholeheartedly that if we had better sunscreens and more enjoyable sunscreens to use, then we help solve that behavioral aspect of sunscreen usage. But I don't think that there's like a great deal of optimism that the FDA will act with any particular urgency in the near future. In 2014, Congress passed an act that was intended to specifically speed along the FDA's evaluation of these ingredients, but it didn't change the data requirements at all for how these get GRACE approved. The experts I spoke with said that they just feel like the FDA is not addressing skin cancer as the public health threat that they believe it is. And that it seems to be by the numbers. So there's just this sort of stagnation, I think, at hand here.
All right. Amanda Mull wrote about why other countries have better sunscreen at The Atlantic. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
This final note on the way out today, the Federal Reserve has put out its Summary of Commentary on Current Economic Conditions, better known as the Beige Book. A sampling of anecdotes from around the country show labor shortages are still a big concern. Here's this from the St. Louis Fed. Contacts across the district reported that workers remained scarce. One staffing firm, which typically filled 30 or more jobs per day pre-pandemic, reported struggling to fill 2 to 3 per day now. This one from Cleveland, quote, tight labor supply prompted one retailer to start recruiting the youngest workers allowed by law. Inflation is also top of mind. Here's one from the Boston Fed. Notable price increases included an 87% increase in Boston hotel room rates between February and May of 2022, far exceeding typical seasonal gains. And for your moment of economic context, this last tidbit from the Beige Book. One major manufacturer in Northwest Mississippi noted that supply chain issues are as bad now as they were at the outset of the pandemic, saying the wheels have fallen off. And this is me now saying, just great. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Amy Scott. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.